Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Glenn A. Severson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Seated, please. This is the time set for oral argument in the case of the Argus Leader, plaintiff and appellant versus James D. Hagan, Secretary of Tourism and Development, defendant appellee. Hearing for the appellant today, Mr. James E. Arneson. Hearing for the appellee is Mr. Neil Fulton. Five justices of the South Dakota Supreme Court have recused themselves from sitting in this case, sitting by designation. Steve Jensen, a circuit judge of Elk Point, South Dakota, from the First Judicial Circuit. Jack Van Wald of Aberdeen, South Dakota, who is a presiding circuit judge for the Fifth Judicial Circuit. Arthur Rush of Vermilion, South Dakota, the presiding circuit judge for the First Judicial Circuit. John Bastian of Belle Fourche, South Dakota, a circuit judge for the Fourth Judicial Circuit. And I'm Glenn Severson of Sioux Falls, a presiding circuit judge for the Second Judicial Circuit. Also want to welcome today class from Redfield High School, I believe criminal justice class, and their instructor, Deb Esser. Mr. Arneson, I believe you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, my name is John Arneson. I probably should correct that. I think the court might have called me James, probably looking at James Hagan's name, but I wouldn't want to blame myself on a James Arneson if there exists one.
And That's my mistake. I'm sorry.
It's all right. My esteemed colleague, Neil Fulton. First, I think on behalf of both Mr. Fulton and myself, I would like to thank you five for stepping up to the plate to accept this case. In light of the recusal of five justices, we're appreciative that you answered the call. A couple of observations I would make before getting started. I don't know if it's a good or bad omen, but on my drive up here this morning from Sioux Falls, and I don't know if you drove up too, Justice Severson, but I've never seen so many pheasants in my life. And in fact, I think I hit a hen with my windshield. So we'll just assume that that's a neutral event. One of my more recent arguments, I appeared in front of a non-judicial tribunal, and after making my argument to what I would call an unreceptive body, in fact, I think contemptuous would be more like it, I got done and sat down, and my opposing counsel stood up and said, I had a lot prepared to say today, but after hearing Mr. Arneson, I don't think I'll need it. So let's hope this is a better day. The facts of this case are pretty much agreed upon. In the fall of 2005, my client, the Argus Leader, asked the governor to see a list of the people invited to the 2005 governor's hunt. That was a request made sometime in November of 2005. They did not get a response. I made some inquiries. I then sent a letter to Secretary Hagan on their behalf. And a couple of weeks later, in late December of 2005, the governor wrote back to my client and denied the request on the grounds that it was a trade secret and or proprietary information. At that point, we filed our mandamus action. which led to briefing by both parties. We argued the case in the spring, March, I believe, 2006. The trial court, the Honorable Max Gores, ruled against us, and that brings us to this point. I think the facts of the case would indicate clearly that what we're dealing with in this case is not the governor's private Christmas list. We're dealing with a governor's hunt invitation list. It's a document presumably kept in some form that's formulated and produced in the ordinary course of the Department of Tourism and State Development's functions. It's part of their official business. So for purposes of this argument today, I will refer to my client as the Argus, and I'll refer to the state's position essentially as the department. The defendant, or the appellee in this case, is James Hagan, who was then the secretary of the department. He has since left that position.
Mr. Arneson, I would just interest, is there any contention that state money was used to put on the hunt, or is that conceded by everybody that there was no state money involved?
Initially, it's private donations to the state, but the moment it becomes a donation, it does go into the GOED fund, which makes it public money. It's not taxpayer money per se. It comes from private donations, but it does become public money.
Okay, thank you.
So essentially what we're dealing with is a document that is used in the performance of official business of the department. Now, the other agency that will prop up during the course of this argument, and I may use it interchangeably with the department, is the Governor's Office of Economic Development, the GOED. And I think the statutes make it pretty clear that the GOED is a component of the department. So basically, we're talking about the department, and if I say GOED, for purposes of this case and any other case that would involve the Department of Tourism and State Development, the GOED is functioning under the department. So at issue, basically, is not the governor's Christmas card list. It's whether this particular document that is prepared and used in the course formulated by the department, by the department's admission, is a document, a government document, that in whatever form is accessible to the public, or should it be a document that can be kept secret at the discretion of the agency. Obviously, we lost that issue at the trial court level, and that's why we're here. The law that pertains to this case comes in two forms. One, the statutory issue, and the second that I'll get into later, these are the two issues that upon which the department rested its case. The second is the question of executive privilege. I'll start with the statutes. We lost this case because the trial court held that there are agency-specific statutes, specifically SDCL 1-52.3.4, I should say 1-52-3.4, which says that the records of, or the information given to, well, I won't gamble at my memory here. I think it's 152-3.5, I'm sorry. All information received by the Governor's Office of Economic Development shall be open to public inspection if it appears, and then it goes on to give the Secretary discretion. The other statute upon which the Department relies is 1-33-19.2, which, oddly, says the Secretary shall maintain the confidentiality of any information given to the GOED. Now, the department has used these two statutes, agency-specific statutes, they say, pretty much give the secretary discretion to do whatever he or she wants with information given to the GOED. But, and I'm sure you're familiar with the briefing in this case, the history of this department is such that when 1-52-3.5 was move 1-33-19.2 should have moved with it. These were contiguous statutes under the old law. For whatever reason...
Mr. Arnson, you don't think that was an accident? Or you think that was an accident, or they just overlooked it?
I think it was an accident. I absolutely think it was an accident, because they are intending to do exactly what they did before with different nomenclature. The Department of Tourism and, I think, State Development combined, and that's why we ended up with a whole new chapter, 1-52.
Mr. Arnson, is there a difference in that they are in different sections? If it wasn't an accident, does the fact that one is in Chapter 133 and one's in 152, is
it
there
It shouldn't make any difference. I just bring it to your attention for the contiguous reading of these two. When you read them back to back, it makes it abundantly clear that the statute upon which the department relies heavily, 1-33-19.2, doesn't all of a sudden take away the discretion that was given under 1-52-3.4. Instead, 1-33-19.2 uses these terms. It's entitled Confidentiality of Certain Information, and then it goes on to say the secretary shall maintain the confidentiality of any information given to the GOED. In our briefs, both the initial brief and the reply brief, I think we pretty clearly show that there are other very specific statutes dealing with information that businesses provide to the GOED and some of the other agencies in the development arena. They supply that information, they must supply that information, and if it does touch upon trade secrets or financial information or specific business-related information that is used by the agency in performing its duties for that business, that's the kind of information that is supposed to be held in confidence by the agency, in this case, the department and the GOED. And my claim is that 133-19.2 pertains to those very specific statutes that protect trade secret information and financial information, financially sensitive, economically sensitive information about a business that a business has to furnish to the agency before it can play ball with. It does not mean, as the department would have us believe, that first we give the secretary this discretion, and then in the very next statute, or what perceivably would be the very next statute, takes it all away. That just doesn't make sense. Our view does make sense. When you use the word maintain, there's an indication that you're preserving something that's already on the books. And in this case, it fits very well with the idea that when somebody else is required to give you business information about itself, whether it's a trade secret or whether it's sensitive financial information, and that the department is then going to use that for the purpose of furnishing assistance to that business, that's a whole different kettle of fish. Therefore, we believe that the agency-specific statutes do not apply, and that we are now back to the more general record statutes that the Argus believes should apply. And that would lead us back into the general South Dakota Open Record Statute, which is 1-27-1. Now, I will admit that if you read 127.1 very literally and very restrictively, one could say, because that only requires you to keep open records, that there's another statute pertaining to. In other words, that there's some other statute that specifically says you have to keep that record and or maintain that record. Those are the only records that are open to the public. Well, our position is this. That's an overly narrow, overly restrictive reading of that statute in today's society. We have a constitution, both at the federal level and at the state level. We have common law and we have case law that can inform our interpretation of that statute. And all the Argus leader is suggesting is this, that statute, when it says something is required to be kept or maintained by another statute, incorporates the concept that those other statutes don't necessarily have to say specifically, there is a governor's hunt and there is an invitation list to a governor's hunt and you shall maintain or keep this. That's an absurd notion Because as our briefs point out, we have in no way expected the legislature to keep up with the proliferation of business of the executive branch in this country, and they haven't. If we look through the South Dakota Code, it's shocking how few times is there reference to specific records and certainly references to specific maintenance requirements for those records. So it is our position that if in the ordinary course of business, statutory business, and these are all statutorily created departments and agencies we're talking about, the executive branch, if to do their job and transact the official business of the state, they create and produce something that is a record document of that act, that's what we think is meant by the term required to be kept by statute. That's what it should mean. Otherwise, I submit to you that we have an executive branch that for the most part, and again, this is a cursory review of any agency you want to pick, for the most part, nothing that they do would have to be disclosed to the public. There aren't that many agents, record-specific statutes in this state.
All right, Mr. Arneson, this is a critical point. We go from the one extreme of a document required to be kept, deeds, court records, down to, as the brief pointed out, phone slips.
Okay.
How do we, there isn't this a job of the legislature to determine where the continuum is between the phone slip and the deed? How are we to look at that and come up with a rule?
First of all, you're right. This would be, in one sense, I mean, let me say this two ways. First, I think you have the authority because you are an interpretive body. I mean, you can interpret the law, and you can bring to bear upon that law the presumptions the Constitution brings, and I think the briefs point that out, that we're talking about a Constitution in South Dakota that still gives the government to the people and makes the government accountable to them. I'm not sure how a restrictive reading of 127-1 would not have to be interpreted, how that statute should not be interpreted more liberally than the department interprets it. But yes, I mean, ideally, the legislature would have stepped in by now and said, this is probably not a very good thing for, it's a little amorphous, a little ambiguous. It's not good for Mr. Fulton, it's not good for Mr. Arneson, it's not good for the court because we can't really understand it. I'm saying in the absence of anything better, this court can step in and say this is what logically should be meant by this statute. And frankly, statute aside, it's not the only one that we have. We also have 1-26-2, which pretty much says any material of the agency is an open record. Now, Mr. Fulton claims, or the department claims, that doesn't apply because it falls under the Administrative Procedures Act. And to that I say the Federal Freedom of Information Act falls under the Federal Administrative Procedures Act, and that doesn't stop anybody from following that as the mother of all Freedom of Information Acts. Now, the fact that we don't have a modernized Freedom of Information Act in South Dakota, I do not think should stand as a stumbling block in this case when we still have our Constitution and we still have the parameter of 127-1 that would have to be read so strictly that it basically diminishes the role of the public, the role of the citizen in a democracy. And I know this sounds like platitudes, but the bottom line is our government in South Dakota is supposed to be informative and accountable. And if you don't have access to what the executive branch is doing, and again, I do not take that every scrap of paper approach, and I understand that it would be nice if there were a black line drawn between this is open, this is closed, this is too trivial to be required to be kept. I do think, though, that there is some reasonable position, and the only one that I'm arguing is something that is a document of the official business of the office.
But, Mr. Arneson, the position you're taking today is different than what the editor of the Argus has been repeatedly saying, is it not? I mean, last Friday's issue, talking about severance pay should be public information, your editor says, quote, state law says that the government has to release records only if the law requires those specific records to be kept.
Okay.
And then he goes on to say, we tried to enact legislation to change it, and it failed.
Okay. Well, here's the bugaboo. Sometimes the attorney and the client we're on the same wavelength, but sometimes a non-legally trained person might say something in response that might not behoove its interest in front of this court, but is an honest assessment of the way he perceives things are going. The reason that the reporter and the Argus Leader is going to the editor in the first place for quotes is because I happen to have a personal view that it's not appropriate for me to give them that quote, certainly during the pendency of litigation and an appeal. And I also don't try to tell them what to say. I don't necessarily agree with that. I mean, I think whoever... It's a perception. I don't necessarily think that that's the way it should be, and I'm arguing that if that's the perception, I admit that that is a perception. I mean, look, we're here, and we're here as losers. We're not here as winners, which would sort of give some support to what was said. But by the same token, I am now in a position for the first time, I believe, to say to this Supreme Court, we're dealing with 127-1. I don't think that's ever been in front of this court before. And I'm asking you to not go off half-cocked. I'm asking for a liberal, logical, reasonable interpretation of that law that would keep the executive branch, essentially the official work product of the executive branch, accessible to the public. We own it.
All right. You're saying the test that you're proposing is a document of public action. Is that correct? Did I write that down correctly? What is your exact line that you are saying or rationale that you would ask this court to adopt?
I guess I haven't been presumptuous enough to write my own law, but I guess I would say that if it's something that is produced that records the official business of the office. In other words, not necessarily the draft, but the final product. And in this case, the discussions that are involved and who gets to come to the governor's hunt, whether Widgie Widget's company is invited, if somebody doesn't want Widgie Widget here because he's not a very good shot, and that's discussed, I'm not thinking that my client is entitled to that information. However, the fact that Widgie Widget is invited to hunt officially in this state at an official function of the state, I think is. And I think my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold. Mr. Fulton.
May it please the court. Neil Fulton on behalf of the appellees, and in light of Judge Von Wald's question, I'm going to say something I never thought I'd say, and that's that I believe the editorial page of the Argus Leader wholeheartedly, at least in its interpretation of 127.1 and how it applies.
You would agree, though, Mr. Fulton, that that matter is outside this record?
Absolutely, Your Honor. But I would agree wholeheartedly that that's the right way to read 127.1, and that's our position. There are three things that the court has to look at in analyzing this case. First, the standard of review, always critical, but particularly critical here. This is the review of the denial of a writ of mandamus. And the standard of review this court applies is abuse of discretion. Recently articulated very well in Maxner v. Maxner, 2007-30, by the Supreme Court. It is a decision that is outside the boundaries of legitimate choice. It is one that is clearly contrary to reason and evidence. That's the first critical thing the court has to keep in mind. Second, we are dealing with very specific statutes tailored to a particular agency and its operation that clearly lay out a framework for how certain information is handled and processed, what is available, what is not available, what is discretionary, what is not. And finally, the court has to keep in mind that we are dealing with a unique area of governmental operation. We are dealing with an entity that is charged with developing private business in the state of South Dakota. This is a horse of a slightly different color. This is not the Department of Social Services placing children. This is not the Department of Corrections holding individuals. This is not the day-to-day operation of government as we typically think of it. This is government acting in the proprietary private business sphere. And as the court cited in Breck versus Janklow, dealing with the sale of another proprietary governmental entity, the state cement plant, there are slightly different rules that apply there for good reason, because you're competing with private business. Let's take those 3 points kind of one at a time. I really think this standard review issue is critical, because Judge Gore's resolved arguments about competing statutes, and we're dealing with the writ of mandamus. It's important to contrast this case with cases where writs of mandamus have been appropriately issued. We look back at the cases cited in my brief, the Duville case. That dealt with a specific statute requiring removal of obstructions of township highways. This is a different case. You look back at the Kirschenman case and the series of cases that have come in the southeast part of the state dealing with referenda on hog confinement and other confined feeding operations. In those instances, we've had a series of cases where there have been questions about whether referenda were appropriately put on the ballot, whether they met the threshold inquiries. This case is different. This is not a specific statute charging someone to simply carry out a duty. There is a statute here, 133.19.2 and 152.3.4, that specifically gives the decision maker, Secretary Hagan, now Secretary Benda, discretion to release information or not. So it is our position that this is not an appropriate case for mandamus. This is just not a statute which creates a clear and of an unequivocal duty on the operator to do a certain thing. This is a statute that by definition and by its terms gave Secretary Hagan discretion on how he would act. And Judge Gore's resolution of that question was within the permissible array of choices. For that reason, we think the standard of review leads you to affirm. In a second, let's...
Were those statutes enacted at the same time, or were they at a different time?
Which statutes, Judge Rush?
The two that you're just referring to that deal with the privacy and the economic development.
I don't know going back if they were initially enacted at the same time, but picking back up on Judge Jensen's questions, was this just a mistake of them being recodified in a different place? I think the answer to that question is yes. When Governor Rounds was elected, there was an executive reorganization order. A lot of agencies and departments were moved into different things for governance and control. GOED was one of them. Department of Tourism and State Development was created, kind of combining what had been separate entities. So if I, and you can look back at the notes of the statute, I think originally, Judge Rush, they were passed at the same time, and then 152.3.4 got moved, and 133.19.2 got left where it was, or vice versa. I forget which one got moved. So,
talking about those statutes, Mr. Fulton, the Argus argues that the output-input distinction in those statutes, and both of those statutes have language talking about information received or information given. And then when you get to the business and trade secret statutes in 116G and 116B, they talk about material made or received. What's your take on that output-input distinction as it relates to the language in 152.3.4 and 132.19.2?
I think that the output-input distinction doesn't make sense and leads to an absurd or unreasonable result, because it would effectively gut the discretion, and it would gut the protection of 133.19.2. Here's the example. In this case, the evidence was Secretary Hagan said, the Governor's Hunt invitation list is formulated based on information given to them. Neil Fulton, Pierce, South Dakota, lawyer, spouse Molly, that information's assembled, and they reprogram it, reprocess it into the list that serves their purposes. If this is something that GOED receives the information and then puts it in the database, puts it in a different format, puts it in a searchable format, puts it by a searchable database based on location, based on business, based on those things, you have suddenly then lost the protection of 133.19.2, which clearly says the secretary shall maintain confidentiality, because by the Argus's argument, it is no longer information given to in the original form. It is our position that the information given to GOED retains these protections and retains its operational character under 133.19.2 and 152.3.4, regardless of whether they manipulate it or change it. It's the fact that it was originally given to them.
That's not what the language says. I mean, there's a difference in the language between those statutes. The business and trade secret statutes talk about received or made. The other one just talks about information received. I mean, I understand your argument, but in terms of just reading the statute, isn't that what the plain language is?
I think it's clear that 116G11, which is the proprietary information statute, for lack of a better way to put it, is just an absolute bar. The secretary can never put that out. I think the other ones, the plain language, is information that is given to. I think if we were talking about some output-input distinction, the plain language would need to read information given to and retained in its original form. An example of that is if we talk about adoption records, you talk about the actual record itself. Here, we're talking about the information, and that's ultimately what the Argus has asked for here. Who are the names of these people? And regardless of whether that's on the list that was originally given to GOED or whether that's on GOED's database, I think it's still information that's given to under the plain language of that statute.
But you're asking us to find there's discretion in that statute, even though it gives the secretary discretion, even though it doesn't specifically say that, for information that the department puts together, like a memo, a hunting list, whatever that might be.
I think that the discretion applies under 52.3.4 to information given to. Yes, I think that is correct. I mean, there is that boundary on the statute. And I think that it's pretty clearly given some discretion there on the information that's given to. So that's, and I may not be understanding your question, Judge Jensen, but that's where we are, is that once the information comes in, 133.19.2 creates a general presumption that you don't give information out. Getting back to this point that it's a somewhat unique entity here, you are competing with private business. If you go ask Microsoft for a list of its primary suppliers, odds are they won't give it to you because they don't want another software company to get it. It's the same thing here. South Dakota has enacted these statutes saying that the Secretary of the Department of Tourism can retain discretion to give the information out to promote business or keep it to not. If you accept the Argus's argument that they can compel this, the next person knocking at the door is the Minnesota Department of Economic Development and Nebraska and Iowa and private business that wants to compete. There is a reason that the statutes have been crafted this way by the legislature, and it is because economic development is different than normal governmental operation. There is a reason there is not a similar statute for the Department of Social Services or for the Department of Corrections or Health. It's because GOED is that instance where the state is putting its foot into the private proprietary realm. And courts have consistently, and this court included, treated proprietary functions differently from classic governmental functions. If you go back to the Oyen versus City of Sioux Falls case, the seminal case on sovereign immunity for municipalities in the state, the Supreme Court said it's different then. You are in a different role. You are not putting out police and firefighters. You are engaged in that case, operating a swimming pool for profit, and you're going to have different protections. We routinely treat proprietary governmental operations differently than we do classic governmental operations, and there's a reason why in this particular setting. If I could go on to a second for the general record statutes, if you throw out for a second these specific statutes, I think, frankly, the argument is better for the state in a lot of ways, because 127.1 is absolutely clear. There is no requirement to make a record open to the public unless there is a statute which requires it to be kept.
Mr. Fulton, what is the effect or what consideration should this court give to, I think it was the Senate Bill 217 that was defeated in this last session, in determining the legislative intent?
I think little or none, Judge Rush. I mean, I was lobbying during the session and familiar with that bill. There's an attorney general study group going on to ascertain what's out there, and that's from, I think it's two sessions ago now, if we count the 07 session. So we're going back to 06. I don't know that you can put much stock in 217, other than the fact that the legislature, a majority of the legislature, determined that we didn't want what was in 217, which I understand. I haven't gone back and compared them verbatim, but I understand is essentially North Dakota's records law. To the degree you put anything into it, I think it says that the legislature says things are fine in South Dakota as they are, or they're saying we're going to wait and see what the Attorney General tells us about whether there's anything we need to change and how we do it.
Well, Mr. Faulkner, if we take your interpretation of 127.1, which is strictly the records that are required to be kept, which presumably would be the, as Mr. Arneson said, the small list of court records and real estate records and minutes and so forth that are specifically set forth in the statutes. What would the reason be for the exceptions in 152, 3.4, and 133, 19.2 to exempt certain documents which are not required under the statute to be kept? What's the legislative intent in having those statutes if the documents that are presented aren't open anyway?
I think that the intent of that is to create a different and specific framework for GOED. You had what was created, the specific statute that says any information given to GOED, presumed confidential. Then you gave the Secretary a little bit of flexibility to say you can make it available if in your discretion, in your judgment, it's beneficial to your purposes. But if the person providing it objects, you can't do it, and then you have the trade secret statutes. I think the intent of the legislature was dealing with a somewhat unique entity, dealing in the unique area they crafted unique and particular statutes for them. I agree. You don't need them. With 127.1, you do not need the statutes in chapters 133 and 152 because, to my knowledge, certainly in the Governor's Hunt list, there is no statute that either requires there to be a Governor's Hunt or for there to be a list. So 127.1 just slams down like a ton of bricks on this case in the absence of these particularized statutes. I don't think you need them. I think the legislative intent was it's a particularized area, it's a particularized operation, and we're going to put them there. Frankly, if I had an idea for why the legislature passes a lot of statutes that aren't necessary, I think we certainly could go down to one 30-day session as opposed to 240 days like people were talking about this year. But 127.1 is the clearest statute this court's going to deal with in this case, because it just says, absent a statute requiring it to be kept, you don't have any obligation to keep it, make it available to the public, anything. And 127.33, Judge Gores' opinion talks a lot about 127.3. I think 127.33 is the better statute, says that the provisions of that chapter don't trump more particularized statutes elsewhere.
What about the bigger question raised by Mr. Arneson in his brief on open government? This is a very narrow statute with your reading of 127. You're saying it should be strictly read and not open to other documents or other interpretation?
I'm saying it should be read as the Supreme Court has consistently said all statutes should be read in the state of South Dakota based on their plain meaning expressed in the text. I think, frankly, this argument about open government and that we're closing down and the people can't see anything is a canard. It is the biggest red herring that keeps being sold in the statute. We are dealing with something that is basically a political fight and has been since the get-go. I am not hearing the hue and cry of people out there who say, I can't get the things we need to operate our government. To the degree there is a problem here, Judge Rush points out, the legislature had a chance to consider that this year, and they didn't accept it. You point out, Judge Severson, isn't this a legislative problem? I think it is. Mr. Arneson says, we need access to these records. We need to know who's coming to this hunt. We need to see this and see that. At the same time, I can argue and would tell my last breath that it is important that GOED be able to keep this information confidential because, again, if they're forced to make public their business prospects, Nebraska can come get them. Minnesota can come get them. Other people compete. If someone is invited to the governor's hunt because they run a plant somewhere in Michigan and they can bring 500 jobs to the state of South Dakota, but they maybe don't want to tell their press back home yet because it'll lead to adverse reaction and maybe the business doesn't come here, that's a legitimate reason why GOED exercises its discretion not to put it out there. So there are competing policy reasons here why things should or shouldn't be open, but the fact is 127.1 sets the law in South Dakota of what is open. There is not, I want to pick up on one argument that ties into this that was in the amicus brief. There is not a First Amendment right of access to government records of the press that is superior to the public. They are constrained by the statutes in place just like everyone is. If you look at the Houchins versus KQED case cited in our reply brief to the amicus, it is clear this is not something where the press has some unique and generalized right. 127.1 makes things available and makes things confidential. It's also important to remember that simply because a statute is not in place requiring it to be kept, if a governmental entity has things and makes them available to the public, there's nothing that prohibits that unless there's some particularized statute that requires things to be confidential. In my practice with state government, I have seen many times when people have asked, can we give this out? And the answer is, nothing prohibits you. You can. And there are things that aren't kept because of a statute. So I think this is a little bit of a sky is falling argument on this open government. To that this statute is some reflection that you just can't get into government activity in South Dakota. I think you can.
In construing 127.1, don't we still need to go back to 132 or 152.3.4? It says all information received shall be open to public inspection if it appears, and you get back to the discretion again. Secretary has, I mean, if it's open to inspection, means they're going to have to keep it unless the secretary decides otherwise. I mean, don't you go back to that statute to look at the Secretary's discretion under 127.1?
No, I don't think so. I think if you look at the statutes that require records to be kept, and we've cited some in our brief, liens, licensees is a big one, a lot of things, whether it's be the state bar, dentists, different things. I think it says shall retain. I think this is slightly different. This is saying that the Secretary has discretion. So I don't think this is that 152.3.4 is a statute that requires the Secretary to keep that information. I think it's one that gives him discretion to use and make public information that he receives, but it's not one that necessarily requires him to keep it. Example, go back a few years in time, Citibank is considering coming to South Dakota, and they say, we're going to give you this information about our operations, and I'm about to go over if I can finish answering this question.
Just finish.
We're going to give you this information about our operations, and the Secretary can say, well, yeah, I'll give some of this out. And Citibank has a right to object and say no, but he can at any point shred the information and get rid of it if he wants to because he's not required to retain it. So for those reasons and the reasons in our brief, we'd ask the court affirm in all respects. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Baldwin. Mr. Arneson.
Thank you. I think the last thing that Mr. Fulton was talking about is indicative of what's the difference between the trade secret case. In this case, we're talking about the possibility of an executive of Citibank being invited to hunt in South Dakota. It's a far cry from the financial background and underpinnings and secrets of how Citibank makes its money. That's the design of our GOED privacy statutes, if you will. That's what they're trying to protect. They're trying to protect the outside entity, the business, the private sector, from having to disclose too much to the public to take advantage of what government is offering them. If they come to the GOED for loans or whatever, the BED, that's what those statutes specifically are designed to cover. We don't have that in this case. We have a party hunt, and I'm not using that pejoratively. It's a party hunt with a governmental function at at the end of the day. And that's what this is. We're talking about, did so-and-so get invited? Not what is so-and-so's business. We're not talking about how Widgie Widget makes his widgets. We're talking about, did he get invited to the hunt? So I think if there is a canard in this case, and I don't believe that the Argus is perpetrating one, and certainly not perpetuating one, if there is a canard in this case, it is that this invitation list is so sacrosanct that the government of South Dakota needs to keep it secret. If it were, and the only real evidence in this case about the hunt, other than Secretary Hagan's affidavit, which is fairly generalized, nonspecific, and I might add Secretary Hagan never specifically responded saying this is my decision in the first place. The real evidence in this case comes from the only thing that we ever got our hands on, which was a list that was submitted of those who came, not invited, but came to the 2004 hunt. And I think from that list, it's pretty clear that if there were two or three or six or 12 names of out-of-state business prospects that the state of South Dakota or GOED or the department thought were really critical to be kept secret for whatever reason, and I'm not saying that those are valid reasons. I mean, screwing the people of Iowa to bring your business to South Dakota indicates to me we may get somebody up here who's going to screw the people of South Dakota to go to Montana. I don't think this is a particularly appealing criterion for keeping secrets. So, number one, I'm not convinced that there's a valid reason. I don't know that the discretion is being exercised in a good way if the whole idea is to do this to another state. Secondly, I think we're being pretty naive to think that if one of the criteria is, well, we need to keep our advantages in South Dakota secret. People are going to move their business to South Dakota for one reason. That is, they're going to be able to make more money here. That's because of the economic climate. Okay? They're not going to come to South Dakota unless there's a good economic climate. That has nothing to do with the pheasant hunt and whether they're invited to the pheasant hunt. And also, they're not going to leave Iowa unless they've decided that Iowa can't better the offer. I mean, it's naive of us to think that we can keep this a secret. Ultimately, economic benefits of South Dakota, whether it's no income tax or cheap labor or reliable labor, I mean, those are things that are pretty much out there in the open. And that somebody might be contemplating leaving another state for that reason, it's not going to be because they haven't explored economically their other options. They're not just going to come to South Dakota because, wow, it's a shot in the dark.
Well, Mr. Arneson, that's getting away, though, from the statutes themselves. How do the statutes, are you saying that we should ignore the statutes that have been passed by the legislature? How do they fit into your argument?
I'm saying that if we do get to the point that we allow Secretary Hagan or whoever the department secretary is to use discretion, the discretion was abused in this case. I think the canard is that there is an economic, a serious economic benefit to South Dakota by keeping the governor's hunt invitation list a secret. Certainly the whole list. Now how maybe a few names brought to the government's attention as people who might be worthwhile to invite would keep Mr. Fulton's name from the public or the Supreme Court's name from the public, all of whom were invited to the 2004 hunt and all of whom attended. I mean, it's an odd notion that everything in the barrel of invitations is poisoned by maybe two or three names, even if there were legitimate reasons to keep those names a secret. And remember, the name of a business or the name of an executive is not a trade secret. I mean, it doesn't fall into that category.
So I'm trying to understand, are you arguing that the secretary abused his discretion?
Well,
if you go back to 152.3.4,
okay.
That statute says all information received shall be open to the public, and then the secretary has discretion to determine whether it should be used consistent with its business purpose. What's the purpose of that statute in your estimation?
First of all, I'm not sure. I can guess. I'm not sure what the purpose of it is because I don't think, well, I can't really read that any other way than to say at some point discretion is given to some information, whether it's open or closed.
Doesn't say all information?
Well, let's assume for say, yes, it does say all information, but see, I don't know that the invitation list comes from outside of government. I mean, that's where I have a hard time. We're told that some of the names might, well, we're told that the department utilizes some outside information. We weren't told that the 2,000 or whatever number of people invited, all those names came from outside of government. So
that's your output-input distinction on
yeah,
that statute.
And I guess I'm not saying that that statute doesn't give some discretion. I'm saying this isn't in that ballpark.
Assuming it does, are you saying failure to produce everything except confidential names or names of prospective business clientele is an abuse of discretion under that statute? Would you argue that?
No. No. I would say, though, that it is the input-output thing, but more importantly, we've never been told that all these names come from outside of government. I did want to, you had asked me earlier about a test, and I would refer you to the administrative rules that I cite on page 20 of my initial brief, and that's SDAR 10:04:01:03 parentheses 2, close parentheses. And that's a rule that says, imposes a duty on department heads or their designee to, quote, maintain records containing complete documentation of the organization, functions, policies, decisions, procedures, and essential transactions of the agency designed to furnish information to protect the legal and financial rights of the state and of persons directly affected by the agency's activities. That says better than I did what maybe the test ought to be on what 127-1 ought to look at as a good guide for making sure we don't have the every scrap of paper required to be kept, but also making sure that government documents what it does and the public is able to go back. The idea that Mr. Fulton brought up that he hasn't heard the hue and cry, and that this is kind of a political Argus versus Governor Rounds type thing, I don't think that's quite fair. I think, first of all, the newspaper has a certain function in society. Secondly, we never said that 100% or even all of the people or most of the people or majority of the people are going to be interested in every aspect of government. If there's one person, if my neighbor is Widgie Widget's competitor and the state of South Dakota is going to bring in Mr. Widgie Widget and my guy's going to go out of business, maybe he has a reason to be able to know who's going to be invited to the governor's hunt. And maybe the public has a right to know who's going to be invited to the governor's hunt just to make sure that in the openness, we don't have that climate that allows a culture of corruption. Now, I don't for a moment attack this administration or any previous administration with which I'm familiar in South Dakota with corruption. But how would we know if we can't see it? And a closed executive branch is the perfect opportunity to take democracy away from the people. And I think really that's all we're trying to do here, is to preserve democracy for the people and let them see what the executive branch is doing. Not looking over the shoulder every day while they're writing notes to themselves, but when they produce something official, we ought to be able to see it.
Isn't your remedy the enactment of a bill like Senate Bill 217 rather than coming and asking us to make new law here in South Dakota?
Well, I think we have, I think both are viable. I think if we have a more specific piece of legislation, I wouldn't have to be here, but I think in lieu of that, I have every legitimate reason to be here, and I think you have every legitimate reason to look at that statute and to interpret it in a way that's consistent with democratic principles and constitutions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Armstrong.